Yesterday, much of the nation paused to remember the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Today, I'll talk with an Iowan about his participation in the civil rights movement working in Mississippi. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Shelton Stromquist is an emeritus professor of history at the University of Iowa. During the summer of 1964, he was a young man with strong principles. He decided to put his life on the line to work for civil rights in Mississippi. This hour, I'll talk with him about his experience as a young white man working to help register black voters in Mississippi. We'll talk about the people he knew and the courage he witnessed. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Yesterday, we paused as a nation to remember the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Today, I'll talk with a man who heeded Dr. King's call. Shelton Stromquist is an emeritus professor of history at the University of Iowa. He was very involved with the civil rights movement from 1964 through 1966, and he's here today to talk about his experiences. Shelton, let's start kind of at the beginning for you. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Chicago area, mostly, suburbs of Chicago, Elmhurst, Park Forest, those areas.
Yeah. So as a young white man growing up in the North, do you remember when you first started to become aware of inequality in this country and find out about the Jim Crow South, et cetera, as you were growing?
Well, I mean, I guess for me, it goes back in part to my mother, who was a teacher and an active member of the teachers union in Park Forest. And I vividly remember, I don't know how old I was, but I was pretty young, riding with her in the car and hearing that a group of people, of whites in Park Forest, had organized to try to buy up property that might be sold to African-Americans. And it turned out that one of our neighbors just down the street was leading this effort. And so we, pardon me, we pulled into the driveway, and I remember her marching down the street and knocking on this guy's door and challenging him over, taking that kind of position. So it was pretty clear to me where her values stood. And I'm sure in a lot of ways that influenced me. But, you know, I think it was probably after I went to college that I really began to be more consistently aware of what was going on in the South particularly.
So in 1963 or 1962, you were at Yale.
Yeah, I went to Yale in 61, actually. Okay. And one of my first encounters there was with Reverend William Sloan Coffin, who was the chaplain at Yale and who himself was quite deeply involved in the Freedom Rides. The Freedom Rides were the effort to integrate interstate bus transportation. And I went to an early orientation aimed at, young students who had some kind of religious background. And Coffin was just back from the South and talked very vividly, along with Marion Wright, later Marion Wright Edelman, about their experiences in the South. So almost from the outset at college, that sort of imprinted on my consciousness. And, for the first 2 years of college, I was somewhat involved.
But it was your time abroad. You left Yale and you traveled to Europe. And you've said that it was really being out of the United States and looking at the U.S. from a distance that really galvanized you. What happened? What was your experience that made you think so differently?
Well, I left the country in June of 1963. So the demonstrations in Birmingham had already happened, and President Kennedy had already submitted to the Congress what would later become the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It didn't pass in 63. So there was, there was a lot on the landscape, so to speak, by the time I left. And when I went to India, I was in India for the summer with a program called the Experiment in International Living, living with families and going around and visiting schools and so forth. And we were often, as a group, called upon to sing a song for the benefit of the audience. And what would we sing? Well, we just inevitably gravitated towards singing We Shall Overcome. It was a song that they knew or they were aware of and that we felt some connection to. So You know, there, I think Indians who had their own tradition of nonviolent resistance, and I had a chance to interact with a number of people who were involved in the Gandhian movement even then. I think they helped me, in a sense, see through their eyes how absolutely unconscionable it was, what was going on in the United States. I then went to Germany, and it was in Germany that in the middle of September, the bombing in Birmingham that killed four young girls happened. And so I was riveted by that and by other developments. Kennedy, of course, was killed in November. And I began to find myself just eagerly consuming what bits of information from abroad that I could gather about what was going on in the United States. And so, but I think this sense of being an American outside of the United States and looking at my country, not as a foreigner, but as transplanted or dislocated, if you will, American, really helped me kind of see with a greater clarity and with greater power what was going on in my own country.
So you made your way back to the United States, right. And you got a ride on a freighter back.
Well,
to the United States?
I didn't have any money to pay my way back, and so I hustled a temporary job on a Norwegian freighter out of Rotterdam, and worked across the country, across the ocean. I didn't know where we were going initially, and they told me we're going to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and I thought, oh, well, that's a kind of interesting destination, given what by that time had come to be a feeling that I really did want to engage in a much more direct way with the coming events in the civil rights movement in the South. So I got off the freighter in Baton Rouge and hitchhiked north for Chicago. And one ride after another took me through Louisiana and then through Mississippi. You know, you never can choose exactly the route you want to go when you're hitchhiking. And, I got in with people, with whites particularly, who were quite antagonistic toward this prospect of volunteers coming south. And I kept my counsel at that point.
Give me an example of maybe one of the exchanges that you had that really made an impression on you when you were hitchhiking across Mississippi?
Well, I mean, I guess the most vivid impression, I don't know that I remember the words exactly, was with a guy in a pickup truck driving through Greenwood, Mississippi. And at some point in his monologue about coming months, he reached behind the seat and pulled out a revolver and said, you know, we're ready for these people. And I kind of said, oh, uh-huh. And we didn't have a whole lot more conversation about that. But it brought home vividly the intensity of feeling that was already there and that was, that could well result in violence.
Well, and I'm sure many of the volunteers who went south for that summer of 1964 probably didn't have a firm grasp on the danger they were putting themselves in. Did that give you a clear idea of how very dangerous this could be even for a white guy in 1964 in Mississippi?
Well, that's one of the hardest things to recall is the sort of mindset that one had under those circumstances. Because I'd been outside of the country, my impressions were fairly selective. I was certainly aware of some of the acts of violence that had been perpetrated against civil rights workers and their supporters. But I don't know that aside from these kinds of exchanges while I was hitchhiking that was in the forefront of my mind. More in the forefront was a sense that this was an important moment and that this was something I wanted to be involved in, and an eagerness to connect with the people from SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Chicago, who I understood were recruiting volunteers. And so I had a lot of catching up to do. But I don't remember at that point, at least, that I was dwelling very much on the prospect of the violence.
So you did volunteer to go to Mississippi. What did you think you would be doing when you were there?
Well, I think it was pretty clear from the interview process and from the discussions that were going on around the in the press and elsewhere, that one of the first things was going to be an attempt to carry forward the effort to register voters. That was sort of the basic that was sort of the basic task. Even though we knew, and I quickly became vividly aware of it, that the prospect, even in a place like Vicksburg, where I ended up going, the prospect of African Americans actually being able to register to vote was almost nil. And yet it seemed important to SNCC and to local activists that this barrier be challenged and demonstrated.
Give me an example, because this is history that we've heard about, and we know that there were barriers to African Americans registering to vote. But can you give me an example of what an experience would have been like for someone who wanted to go and register to vote, and of course had the right to register to vote, but would not be able to? What did they encounter?
Well, I think I have to step back for just a moment and talk about the differences within even a state like Mississippi between conditions that African Americans encountered at that local level. On the whole, Mississippi was regarded by the civil rights movement and by SNCC after four bitter, difficult, dangerous years as the most difficult state to break into, that the barriers were that much greater. I mean, I think in 1960, the data suggests that less than 5% of eligible African Americans were registered to vote. There had been murders on the courthouse steps of people going up to register to vote, and being shot dead in Amite County in Liberty, Mississippi. Herbert Lee and then Lewis Allen in 1961 and 62 had been killed, literally. There were some parts of the state where the risks of violence, of personal attack, in just going to attempt to become a full-fledged citizen were enormous. And so those represented a very great challenge. In places like Vicksburg, there was resistance. There was the prospect of people being challenged physically as well as inside the registrar's office. But the personal risks were not quite as great. The risk of violence, of public violence, was not quite as great as it was in some parts of the state. The routine, if you will, was to do educational sessions in meetings and in one-on-one in people's homes about what people might encounter when they went to the courthouse. And this was based on kind of other experience that people had had. And then kind of, you know, reviewing the kinds of questions that they might ask, unreasonable though they were. And then accompanying people to the courthouse, but not going with them up to the courthouse. That was their challenge, and that was their risk that ultimately they had to bear.
We'll take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Shelton Stromquist. He's an emeritus professor of history at the University of Iowa and worked in Mississippi during the Summer of Freedom, 1964. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Yesterday, we as a nation paused to remember the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And today on Talk of Iowa, I'm talking with Shelton Stromquist. He's an emeritus professor of history at the University of Iowa and as a young man was very involved in the civil rights movement from 1964 to 1966. He grew up in Chicago and became very actively involved in the summer of 1964, traveling to Mississippi, working to help African Americans register to vote. And Shelton, we'll talk more about the work that you did in Mississippi, but I want to talk about one of the other volunteers that you worked with. His name was Andrew Goodman, and he was actually involved in the same orientation that you were involved in.
Right, right. The first orientation at Oxford, Ohio, which was the site that was chosen to do the orientation. I mean, I think the SNCC organizers realized early on that there was going to need to be some preparation.
And that's SNCC is the
Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Correct. And so these orientation sessions were set up. This was the first one. This was the one that was designed to try to prepare people to do the kind of work I was just talking about before the break, the voter registration work and ultimately helping to organize the Freedom Democratic Party. You know, most of us were new to each other. We didn't know each other. We lived in dorms. We met over meals. We talked in sessions. We played roles during role-playing sessions. There were some very vivid role-playing sessions in which we were asked to play the role of antagonistic whites when SNCC workers tried to go to register to vote. And so these were very emotional sessions in which people's tensions and people's anxieties expressed themselves in pretty vivid ways. The SNCC workers often laughed about how we took a little too seriously our our roles as antagonists in that situation. But Andy Goodman was, was somebody that I didn't know well. I got acquainted with briefly. We lived on the same hall. And as the week went on, we sort of each of the volunteers gravitated toward a different site in Mississippi and began to interact more intensively with the people who were going to that site. And for whatever reasons, and it was often kind of just happenstance, Andy gravitated toward the group that was going to Meridian, Mississippi. Mickey Schwerner had been working in Mississippi for a number of years, as had James Cheney. They, I believe both of them, at least for part of the week, were there. That is James Cheney and Mickey Schwerner. In any case, it turned out late in the week that Mickey Schwerner got word that a church that they were hoping to use for registration training in Philadelphia, Mississippi, had been burned to the ground. And so he felt some urgency to get back to Mississippi to investigate this and try to provide the documentation to the authorities. And so he and, as I recall, he and Andy and James Cheney headed out early, perhaps a day before the rest of us. I was with a group that was had gravitated toward the work in Vicksburg, and we headed out in a car about a day later. We actually perhaps a little unrealistically, feared that there was the possibility, at least in crossing into Mississippi, that we'd all be arrested immediately, given the antagonism that we knew was there. So we decided to skirt through Louisiana and down to a town across from Vicksburg and just cross into the city rather than going through the state. We did that. We arrived early on a Sunday morning and immediately were told by the people at the Freedom House where we went that three civil rights workers had disappeared and that they had been in Meridian. They'd gone to investigate in Philadelphia and now they were gone. Nobody could track them down. And we knew immediately who they were. This was a shock. People that we had just been with and people that we felt we knew, at least to some degree, suddenly found themselves. And we were sure. I mean, everybody knew, even though the press was very ambivalent about what had happened. Maybe they'd skipped off to the north. They were just – it was just a publicity stunt right. In all of this. We knew. We knew they were gone.
And so it – that was in June.
That was in June, yeah.
June 21st.
21st, yeah. Yeah.
And about. Their bodies were not discovered until August.
That's correct. That's
so
correct.
So there were a lot of questions, but – you knew.
We knew
something.
We knew they had been killed, and right. it was only a matter of time until their bodies were found. But so initially, this really had a kind of immobilizing effect on us. Our worst fears had been realized, not for us but for others, and
you knew your life was in danger as well.
Yeah, at least to some degree. We knew that we had. There was the potential for that kind of thing to happen to any of us. I mean, we actually had a community center on the outskirts of Vicksburg that was burned to the ground, and we went out to investigate it found a gas can in the back of the what had been the community center that was clearly the incineration device, was clearly an act of arson. We documented it, photographed it, sent all the material to the FBI. Nothing happened. So this kind of thing was going on all around the state, and there were, at varying degrees of risk, depending on where you were in the state and what the specific timing was.
Now, we've talked a little bit about the work that you were doing trying to help African Americans register to vote, but you were also very involved in political organizing. What were you trying to accomplish?
I think it's important to step back for just a moment and to mention that you know, this was a movement that was ongoing in Mississippi. We didn't create it. We came into it as volunteers. And so there had been, there had been ongoing attempts to try to register to vote, not on the scale that there were during the summer of 64, but still persistent attempts to challenge those barriers. There had also been an attempt to cast what was called a freedom ballot in the fall of 1963 that involved local activists in communities all around the state casting, sort of mock ballots. It was kind of a mock vote because people couldn't they weren't registered. They weren't allowed to register. They couldn't actually vote. So this was another attempt to kind of demonstrate on the part of the local movement the kinds of barriers that existed. As the planning went forward for the summer of 64, there was a strong feeling that with the Democratic National Convention coming up in August, that it was very important for Mississippi African-American Democrats to have a voice at that convention. And one way to do that, given the exclusion that they faced when they had tried to attend precinct caucuses, was to hold alternative caucus meetings, to hold caucus meetings for what came to be called the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, and to go through all of those steps that you have to go through if you're organizing a political party and you're organizing caucuses at the precinct and the county and the state level to elect delegates who could go and represent you at the national convention. So that was kind of the thinking behind that, to bring to bear the sort of light of national publicity on the extent to which the Mississippi regular Democratic Party did not represent African Americans, in fact, actively excluded them. And so to put before the Democrats, the national party, the challenge, you know, are you going to accept this, that you know, units of your party in states not only in Mississippi but across the South are actively excluding and participating in the prevention of African Americans from full participation.
In that role, you were working with local organizers as well. And one of the men that you were working with was named Willie Johnson.
Right.
And can you tell me a little bit about the work that the two of you were doing and an experience that you had organizing a meeting?
Yeah. We kind of – there weren't a whole – there wasn't a large number of us who were directly involved in the FDP organizing, the Freedom Democratic Party organizing. But there were a handful that included local activists, both longtime residents of Vicksburg and a couple of younger college students who were home from historically black colleges where they were attending and who wanted to get involved in the summer effort. Willie Johnson was one. Johnny Ferguson was another. And Harold Ickes, who was the son of FDR's commerce secretary and later an important figure in the Clinton administration, was also in Vicksburg. And so we kind of divided the labor. And Willie and I worked in the county, and Harold and Johnny worked in the city. And we would contact people in different areas. We'd explore the possibility of organizing meetings, of pulling people together for educational purposes, and then ultimately to hold precinct caucuses. One of the most painful incidents during the summer for me personally was that Willie and I were going to contact deacon of a church who had indicated that he would be prepared to support the idea of holding a caucus in his church. And he lived out in the country, you know, an isolated homestead. It happened to be at a T intersection. As we were driving to his house, we passed a car that had a couple of white guys in it who looked very long and hard at us because we were a mixed race
pair
in the car. And we drove ahead. We knew where the house was. I looked in the rearview mirror. I was driving. I could see that this car turned around and was starting to follow us. And so I realized the house was right at the T. We approached the house. I tried to decide, what do we do here? But we decided we could possibly get in behind the house without being seen, and then we could go ahead and have our meeting. So we did that. As it turned out, we later from the front window watched the car approach, turn, and go by very slowly. Obviously, they had seen or suspected that that's where we had stopped. We had our meeting, planned the caucus session. You know, it was a very congenial meeting. The man, Henry Owens, and his wife, Lucy, offered us refreshments. And when the meeting was over, we got back in our car and left, as far as we could tell, unobserved. We came back to the Freedom House, and sometime the next day, or it might have been the day after, we got a phone call that Henry Owens and his wife had somebody had seen a truckload of Klansmen in full regalia, so to speak, approaching the house and had driven past. But we later learned that the Klan had gathered there, had dragged them out on the yard and beaten them. Had beaten them up with rifle butts. They survived. But they were badly injured, taken to a hospital. But it was indicative of the enormous risks that local people were taking.
And clearly very difficult for you. Did you feel responsible?
I did, in a certain sense. I mean, we knew that this was an effort that grew out of the community, that there was strong sentiment of support for it. There was a sense that this was a very special moment that had to be seized. This wasn't our sense. It was a sense that came from the community. On the other hand, by our very actions, we were putting people in harm's way, in part because those of us who were white were very visible and very identifiable and very trackable, so to speak, in these efforts. And it was harder to disguise them and hide them, as was the case here.
Did you think about giving up and going home?
I don't remember that I did. I felt terrible. We contacted the FBI, as we always did in these kinds of cases, and as almost always happened, there was no response. There was a part of the Civil Rights Act that said that if officials of the government, Justice Department marshals or FBI officials, saw people's rights being violated or had reason to believe that their rights might be violated, that they could intervene proactively. But we were consistently told by people in authority that that was not their role. They were not going to exercise that kind of role. And so we were always skeptical about how much relief there might be from any investigation that might follow incidents like this. So this was for me, and I think for many of us in Vicksburg, a low point in the summer. There were high points, but this was very much a low point.
Well, let's talk about one of those high points, because you were working very hard to organize these precinct caucuses. What happened when it came time for the caucuses?
Well, it was something we've been working for and planning for pretty much all summer. The moment arrived, and we had caucuses lined up in all of the precincts. And Willie and I, who had been working in the county, had worked very hard to try to hold to arrange for a caucus meeting, even in the what we called the plantation land. Area of the county. In the northern part of Warren County is very much like the Delta. It's old cotton plantations that are mostly farmed by sharecroppers, by black sharecroppers. It's white-owned land. It's very impenetrable in a certain sense. People live in a very closed world, a closed and controlled world, and their ability to exercise any rights are limited. So we had worked in this area of the county. We'd established some good contacts. We had reason to believe that there was actually going to be possible a precinct meeting in a church on that plantation land, on land owned by a white landowner. So caucus day came. We had a series of meetings. This was going to be the last meeting in this church on plantation land. And we were running behind. Jim Foreman, who was the chairman of SNCC at that point nationally, was our featured speaker. And we, you know, Willie and I were kind of the advance team. We'd go to each site. We'd make sure people were there, kind of prepare the ground for the meeting, and then go on to the next site as the meeting got going. And we had three or four of these scheduled across the county that we were directly involved in. So it got to be late in the day. This was our last meeting. We were going to the plantation area. We were running half hour, 45 minutes, maybe an hour late. The meeting was supposed to have already started, and we drove into the plantation land, got to the church, and there wasn't a soul there. The church was empty. And, you know, we said to ourselves, well, you know, we're not surprised. We're not surprised because the risks that people would take coming to a meeting for this purpose were so enormous. And so we got out of the car. We were standing on the porch trying to decide what to do, and looked out. And it was out in the middle of a field, more or less, except for a tree or two. And looked out, and in the creek beds that were wooded, we could see movement. Initially, we thought, whoa, this doesn't look good.
Right.
As we watched, it turned out it was African Americans
coming to the meeting.
Coming to the meeting, who were had been waiting to see if we would in fact show up, and we did, and they did, and it was the most raucous meeting of the day.
We'll have to take a break here. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Shelton Stromquist. He's an emeritus professor of history at the University of Iowa. And we are remembering 50 years ago, in 1964, he spent the summer working in Mississippi with the civil rights movement, trying to help African Americans register to vote, political organization, and also organizing these precinct caucus meetings that we were just talking about before the break. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. But I also want to invite you, if you were involved in the civil rights movement, give us a call and share a little bit of your story at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And just before the break, Shelton, we were talking about that meeting, the most raucous meeting of those precinct caucuses that you organized. And when you arrived at the meeting site, there was no one there. You and your partner, Willie Johnson, you stood on the porch of that church and you watched people come out of hiding to come to that meeting. What did that feel like?
Well, it was a moment of euphoria because it confirmed for us how deeply committed people were to this effort and how willing they were to take what were for them enormous risks. But, you know, as the church filled up and people, you know, I think there was something about, especially in that part of the county, something about gathering in a space where they felt some degree of freedom, where they could gather with their neighbors and talk freely and exercise their rights. There was something just incredibly energizing about that moment. And when Jim Foreman and the others arrived, we had kind of kept the meeting going with music and songs and short speeches. But eventually Foreman got there and, you know, I remember him turning to me as he came in and he said, "Nice crowd." And I said, "Yeah, not bad."
So that summer, so much happened that summer all over the United States. And of course, that was the summer that President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964 in July. But there was still so much work that had to be done after that summer. You went back to school.
Mm-hmm.
And you went back to Yale, and you were involved in what you could be involved with there at Yale and on campus. you were, what, president of the Yale Civil Rights Council?
Right.
And that fall, the Freedom House in Vicksburg, where you had spent so much time during the summer,
right.
that fall in October, it was bombed.
Right. Well, one of the interesting, in retrospect, it's hard to call it interesting exactly, but one of the curious moments was late in the evening. We were always a little worried as evening set, and it was a hot summer. It was Mississippi in August, July and August, and we would tend to gather on the front porch. And even though we knew we were in a kind of position of vulnerability, it was a house that was kind of up on the hill a little bit, and there were some woods around, but there was a clear path of vision from the road going by. And one night we were sitting on the porch and we saw a car approaching that entrance to the driveway. And all of a sudden we saw and then heard the report of what must have been a pistol. And we all hit the deck, discovered a bullet hole later on the porch, but clearly somebody had intended us harm. So we were a little bit on edge every evening as the summer proceeded. And one evening, a couple of carload, really three or four young guys, white guys from the city, showed up unannounced. We had no idea who they were. They walked up and they said, "You know, can we talk?" And so we started talking, and it was kind of a little awkward at first. But finally, they said to us they'd been hearing talk in the gas stations and other places that somebody intended to bomb the Freedom House. And we weren't quite sure why they were telling us this. But for their own reasons, whatever they were, they told us. And so we doubled our caution and concern. But nothing happened to the Freedom House during the summer. Then in early October, I was back at Yale, got a phone call early one Sunday morning, and somebody who I'd worked with during the summer, lived in New York, Paul Cowan, who called, said they did it. They got it. And it turned out that a dynamite bomb, a very powerful dynamite bomb, had been planted under the Freedom House. It was one of those houses that was up on stilts, so it was possible to get underneath it. They planted it right in the center of the house, and the house had been destroyed. There were, I don't know, six or eight people in the house at the time. No one was killed. No one was seriously injured. There were a lot of cuts of flying glass. But what was clear was that the reason no one was killed is because the bomb, unbeknownst to the bombers, had been planted under the Freedom Library. And so these were books, boxes of books stacked floor to ceiling that had been donated by Northern supporters. And there were, you know, we were overwhelmed with books, way more books than we could use in the Freedom Library and the Freedom School. And so they never got unpacked. They were just sitting there in the middle of the of the building. They didn't know it, but they planted the bomb right under those books. And, you know, it didn't prevent serious destruction of the house, but it did
absorb
enough
yeah.
that no one was killed. And
wow.
we, you know, all of us who knew that house and knew that situation were convinced that that was part of the reason why.
We're talking about the civil rights movement. Shelton Stromquist is an emeritus professor of history at the University of Iowa. He spent the summer of 1964 working in Mississippi, the summer of freedom. And you're welcome to join our conversation as well. If you were involved in the civil rights movement, tell us a little bit of your story at 866-780-9100. Lillian is on the line in Fairfield. Hello, Lillian.
Good morning, Charity. I appreciate you and your work. So much.
Thank you. And you were very involved in the civil rights
movement.
Yeah,
I'm 92 now, and I have very interesting, vivid memories of what we did in those days. My education started when I joined a group in Los Angeles called Women for Legislative Action. And we wrote letters, and we joined demonstrations, and we organized different activities. One thing I remember was there was a chain of stores called Vandy Camps in Los Angeles, and they would not hire any people of color. So we organized what we called a sip-in. We did sit-in, too, but we organized a sip-in. And, we would sit at a table and order a 10-cent glass of tomato juice and tie up the place, essentially. And the police would come by every time we went on a demonstration, whether it was at the federal building or wherever it was. The police would come by in Los Angeles. The police belonged to most of them to the John Birch Society, and they were very, very, very conservative. And they would call us Pinko, you know, and ridicule us and do all that. It was a very, also I demonstrated for, against apartheid in South Africa. We were very, very active, and of course against the Vietnam War, which is another subject. But it was a very perilous time, and it was very, I was never in danger, but it was a very significant time of my life.
Well, Lillian, before I let you go, I'm going to ask you a question that I'm going to ask Shelton here in just a moment. You know, we just spent time this past summer remembering the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and Dr. Martin Luther King's famous speech there at the Lincoln Memorial.
Right.
This coming summer will be the 50th anniversary of that summer of 1964. How do you think the nation should mark that?
How do I think the nation should mark it?
What do we need to remember from that summer?
I don't know, to do what you're doing now, having a program discussing the issues that were current at that time. I don't know how they should mark it. It's probably going to be an individual thing from city to city or state to state. But it was a very... I was not on the March of Washington, but I certainly... I didn't participate, but I certainly was aware of it and saw it on television and all.
Right. Well, I asked the question because as our children are learning this history, I think it's very hard for them to fully grasp what people were experiencing.
And they should teach it in the schools.
And I think they are, and I think they will. Well, Lillian, thank you so much for joining the conversation today. And Shelton, you know, talking with you today and hearing your emotion and talking about the risks that you took personally and the great risks that so many of the people that you encountered were taking. I mean, you talk about the deacon and his wife agreeing to host a precinct caucus, and that was a decision that could have gotten them killed very easily, and it did get them brutally beaten. So many people were so brave and so courageous, and the stakes were so high. In this summer, when we will be thinking back on that time, what are some of the lessons that you think we need to focus on, some of the experiences that we need to remember beyond the marches and beyond the speeches and beyond the legislation?
Well, I guess a couple things come to mind. I mean, listening to Lillian talk about the work that she was doing in Los Angeles is a reminder that this was not just a problem in the South. This was a problem that the whole country faced, and that people in communities in the North were struggling with in terms of housing, in terms of jobs, in terms of discrimination in public places. And so I think it's important, you know, as important as it is to think about what went on in the South, to realize that this was a national problem that in some sense touched the lives of people throughout the country. I guess the second thing, as I think about how we might commemorate it. And, you know, these anniversaries are, in one sense, kind of artificial. You know, what's 50 years? Why not 51 or 49? But it is an opportunity to kind of focus attention in a way that doesn't just happen year in and year out. And so I think that opportunity has to be seized. But what I would hope is that beyond the story of the leaders and beyond the story of white volunteers who went south to work lies the story of people struggling in their own communities across the South to build a movement that would transform their lives. And I hope that one way or another, the focus of this commemoration can be directed toward them. I went back to Vicksburg in the summer of 1994, which was 30 years after the Summer Project. And, you know, I went back to – I was in Jackson for some kind of general celebration, but went back to Vicksburg and walked the streets, went to a cafe, was served by a waitress who was a young girl during those years and remembered who we were, walked into the barbershop of Eddie Thomas, who was one of the core leaders, and he hadn't seen me in 30 years. And was in the middle of cutting somebody's hair and turned to me and said, "Shell, what are you doing here?" And it turned out that people like Eddie Thomas are teaching this history year in and year out to high school students in Vicksburg and across the South. The other thing is that there are now museums. There are now historic markers. There are historic sites across the South. And there's an opportunity for people to engage that history at a local level and to get some sense of the richness of that struggle as it played out in people's lives.
Your story continued, of course. I mean, you went back to Yale. You were president of the Yale Civil Rights Council. And you went back, you went to Selma, actually, mm-hmm. after Bloody Sunday, after that march was stopped, and with the intention of marching. You continued to try to be involved, but at some point you decided that this wasn't your struggle. What made you make that decision?
Well, it was a recognition that happened over a period of time as the movement itself was changing. I mean, there'd always been a certain amount of tension between some elements of SNCC in particular and white volunteers. There were cultural differences, there were different styles, there were different perceptions, and so there was a sense that as valuable as summer volunteers might have been in focusing national attention on conditions in Mississippi, where SNCC had been working for years anonymously, basically, without any attention and risking their lives terribly, these SNCC workers, there was an acknowledgement that there was a time when whites could play a useful role. But there was also an ongoing recognition that that time was passing, and it was a black movement. It was the movement of African-American people to claim their rights and to organize for their rights, and that the continuing role for white people in that movement was diminishing. And even though I was along with many others involved at one phase or another in the Selma March, coming from the North, and even though I went back to Vicksburg in the summer of 1965 and then joined the James Meredith March after he was shot in June of 1966, by that time it was clear that, it was time for me personally, but also time for white activists in the movement to begin to move on, and that this was Black Power had a legitimate meaning, and it was an important phase that the movement was going into, and this had to be led by African Americans.
This was an important time that really shaped our nation. For you personally, it was clearly an important time for you. How do you think it shaped you to have volunteered, to have been part of this experience?
Well, I think it gave me a sense that social movements are built from the bottom, that what's important is not so much national symbols and national leaders or even national legislation, though that's clearly absolutely important. But the way that happens is that people organize and organize locally and build grassroots movements that have a strength and integrity and a kind of rootedness, grassroots literally, that give them vitality that makes efforts to pass national legislation possible. I recognize the importance of leadership, but I recognize even more the importance of local folks doing what they have to do in their own communities.
Shelton, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Shelton Stromquist is an emeritus professor of history at the University of Iowa. This hour, we've been talking about the work that he did with the civil rights movement from 1964 to 1966. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can send email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, Centerville, Iowa, a mid-American saga. This is Talk of Iowa.